Right. Oh, there you are, Mr. Miller. You're on the screen now. But, Mr. Patton, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Tom Patton. I represent Clayton Wagner. Mr. Wagner is not an armed career criminal after the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson because he does not have three prior convictions for violent felonies. The district court found that Mr. Wagner's two Ohio aggravated burglary convictions and his Ohio attempted robbery conviction were violent felonies. We believe that that was wrong. And I'd start off with the two aggravated burglary convictions. The first argument on this point is that when Mr. Wagner filed his first 2255 motion, the government argued to the district court specifically that the Ohio burglary convictions did not constitute generic burglary under Taylor's definition, but that they did constitute violent felonies under ACCA's residual clause. Now, they didn't just say the judge didn't have to address whether or not they were generic burglaries because they would qualify. They affirmatively said they were not. And in the government's brief in this case, they explained that that was not an oversight, that was not a mistake. It was a litigation strategy dictated to come determined by Maine Justice and pushed out to the U.S. Attorney's Office across the country to make the argument to concede that a burglary statute that involved entry into vehicles was not generic burglary, and to argue that those convictions were still violent felonies, but under the residual clause. And the district court agreed with them.
Mr. Patton, if I could interrupt and take a step backward. Your client wasn't sentenced under the residual clause, right? Well, his ACCH status wasn't determined under the residual clause for any of the qualifying convictions, and more particularly for these two burglary convictions. They were counted as ACCA burglaries, right?
They were certainly counted as ACCA burglaries, and that was set out in the pre-sentence report, identified the two Ohio burglaries and the attempted robbery conviction as the three violent felonies that constituted, that made Mr. Wagner an armed career criminal.
So there was no Johnson error at sentencing. You can't claim that there was a Johnson error at sentencing because he wasn't sentenced under the residual clause.
I think the most anyone can say about the original sentencing is at best it's what I would refer to as a silent record case, as that it was not explicitly stated one way or the other as to whether or not they were violent felonies because they were enumerated generic burglaries or they were violent felonies under the residual clause. Now, I will say that in 1990, almost a decade before this case was decided, the Sixth Circuit in the United States versus Lane had already identified that Ohio's burglary statute, because it covered entry into boats, railroad cars, airplanes, and cars, was not generic burglary, a violent felony under the residual clause. So that there was well-established case law that Ohio burglaries were broader, that weren't generic burglaries because they were much broader than Taylor's definition of generic burglary, but that they counted as violent felonies under the residual clause. So I don't think you can assume that they were not found to be violent felonies under the residual clause because there was, in this court in United States versus Davis, had cited Lane approvingly. Lane was actually attempted burglary, but they noted that the Ohio burglary was broader. And this court knew of Lane because it cited Lane in United States versus Davis, finding that Illinois attempted burglary was a violent felony under the residual clause. So defense counsel just would have had no reason at that time to object to the Ohio burglaries because they were going to count under the residual clause. So I don't, I guess I don't agree that you can affirmatively say they were not based on the residual clause. And I think if you look at the status of the law at the time, it is much more reasonable to find that they were under the residual, they were found under the residual clause. But I also think that at this point, the question is, there's no doubt that for the past decade or more, Mr. Wagner has been serving this ACCA sentence based solely on the residual clause. And we know that because of Judge Baker's opinion in denying his first 2255 motion.
Well, I'm having some difficulty understanding that opinion and order because the judge distinguishes Ohio's burglary statute from DeCamps. I mean, the argument that was raised in the first 2255 was the DeCamps argument, which is the same argument that's being made here as amplified by Mathis. But the judge said, no, this isn't like the statute, the burglary statute in DeCamps. So the judge addressed the merits argument of classifying this as an ACCA burglary, these two convictions as ACCA burglaries, and then pivoted without any transition language to the discussion of the residual clause and the citation to the residual clause language. And it's not, you know, there's no determination one way or the other, just exactly what the judge is doing in terms of classifying these convictions, and just a summary rejection of the 2255 motion after that.
I understand what you're talking about, Your Honor, but I would disagree in that what Judge Baker finally says, his ultimate conclusion is, yeah, the statute's a little different than in DeCamp, but, and this is at page 48 of our appendix, he says that the statute defines the term violent felony as the use, attempted use, threatened use of physical force against a person of another, burglary. I'm sorry, I was reading the wrong paragraph. He says that the issue charge, the lesser charge of burglary under Ohio law, quote, involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, and cites the residual clause. So that's what the government had argued to him in their response to the 2255 motion.
I mean, was it in the nature of a harmless error argument? Did the government?
Well, I don't think it's
conceded error to the extent that these two convictions were classified as ACCA burglaries, and argued that the error was harmless because they could be counted under the residual clause.
Your Honor, I would rephrase it in that I think what the government was saying is that he does not have a claim that he was unconstitutionally sentenced as an armed career criminal, because although the Ohio burglary convictions were not generic burglaries, they still were violent felonies under the residual clause. Therefore, there's no claim. And I think that ties in with what this court said in Cross, that there isn't a claim to 2255 relief if the convictions are violent felonies under the residual clause, even if they aren't violent felonies under the enumerated clause. Because to actually have a claim to 2255 relief, you have to show that your sentence was imposed in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States. And as long as the convictions still count as violent felonies under either clause, you don't have a claim. And so I think what the government's argument was, and I don't think, I mean, it's what they wrote and told Judge Baker, was, yeah, they don't count under, they're not generic burglary, so they're not enumerated burglary, but there's no claim to relief because they constitute burglary under the residual clause. And they are now, of course, saying exactly the opposite. They are arguing that they are generic burglaries. And courts just don't let litigants do that. And for good reason. They don't let a litigant take one position in one phase of a case and win and then come back in a later phase of the case and take a diametrically opposed position to try and win again. That's judicial estoppel. We also, it's collateral estoppel. You don't let, when there's mutuality of parties and mutuality of issues, you don't, and an issue gets resolved, gets litigated to a conclusion, it's binding. You don't get do-overs. And so we don't think the court should allow the government to do that here. And we think the district judge erred in doing that. But on the merits, we think that Ohio burglary, aggravated burglary, excuse me, also doesn't qualify. There seems to be no disagreement that the aggravated burglary statute applies to a car that someone happens to be living in. The government didn't dispute that. The case they rely on, Greer, acknowledges that the Ohio aggravated burglary can apply to a vehicle that's not adapted or accommodations are made to accommodate overnight guests, just a regular car. But if somebody happens to be living in their car and it's a time where they're likely to be present, it can be burglary. So we're definitely dealing with a car. So then the question becomes, because the person is living in their car, is that enough to take it within STIP? Because obviously the Supreme Court in Taylor said we're not treating breaking into cars as the same as breaking into a dwelling or a building. That's the whole reason why Taylor came up with their generic offense, because they wanted to treat breaking into cars differently than breaking into houses. And they recognized that some states' burglary statutes did cover breaking into cars. And part of the reason they made this distinction that they wanted to limit it, and they said this, was they were limiting it to buildings or dwellings, is because it's dangerous because people are more likely to be present or come to investigate whether it's a building or dwelling, and that the defendant knows that because he can obviously see if it's a dwelling or a building. And instead, the Supreme Court said that reasoning also applies to RVs, vehicles that have obvious changes made to them to show that people can camp in them, live in them. And so it is a marriage of higher risk, but that the defendant can discern that risk, but still decides to go ahead and commit the crime. And that adds to the level of dangerousness. And that's just not present when you're going to break into a car that, as far as the defendant knows, is just a car, but it turns out somebody's living in it. And the Sixth Greer opinion acknowledges that. The way it puts it, it says, yes, we're putting the defendant's knowledge on the back burner. It's our position that that's wrong, not consistent with Taylor. And if I could, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, counsel. Miller?
May it please the court. The defense says that you don't get do-overs in federal court. The defendant is asking for his second do-over. He did not contest his ACC status at his original sentencing or on appeal or on direct appeal. The question here is whether the defendant is entitled to relief in a successive Section 2255 proceeding. And here he is not, because he is clearly relying on Mathis and its progeny and not on Johnson. To address the question regarding the original sentencing, it was clear that the defendant was being sentenced for the robbery conviction based on the enumerated offenses. I'm sorry, on the elements clause and on the burglaries as enumerated offenses. And as the court likely recalls, at that time back in 2002, under this court's jurisprudence, there was no reference to the residual clause for these offenses, because under the modified categorical approach as it was then applied, courts would look to the charging document as to what the defendant was charged with. And in this case, it was clear in each one of these burglaries, two burglaries in Ohio, two burglaries in Georgia, one burglary in Virginia, actually, that is not at issue here. All of those burglaries involve entering a dwelling or a residence or a business. So there was no question under the jurisprudence at the time that these qualified under the enumerated offenses clause or the elements clause as burglary. So there was no discussion of the residual clause. This was not a Johnson error at the original sentencing. It was not a Johnson error on appeal when the defendant did not raise the issue. And as we brief, we believe that the weight of authority indicates that Johnson doesn't open the door. I think this court said it in Sotelo. It doesn't open the door to any and all challenges to the Armed Career Criminal Statute because the claim has to be a legitimate Johnson claim. And the authority says that it's the defendant's burden to establish, in most cases, say by a preponderance of the evidence, that the defendant was sentenced based on the residual clause to bring a Johnson claim. And as the defense has said, it's at best for the defense, it's a silent record. There's certainly no evidence that the defendant was sentenced on the residual clause. And we argue that in fact, the existing law at the time shows the defendant wasn't sentenced on Johnson. The defendant was sentenced on based on the enumerated offenses and the elements clause.
What's the effect, counsel, of Judge Baker's order on the first 2255? Was that essentially a reclassification of this conviction, these two convictions, as residual clause convictions?
Well, and I'll address that. First, we don't think that what happens in the section 2255 later after the sentencing and direct appeal can then turn this into a Johnson error. That had to happen at the original sentencing on direct appeal. But second of all, the court has read the opinion of Judge Baker. We've read the opinion of Judge Baker. It isn't really clear. He addresses a lot of claims because the defendant raised a lot of claims. He briefly addresses the claim that the defendant is not an ACC. The government did say, we don't hide from that at that time, based on the jurisprudence, said there's no reason from the Department of Justice position to try to make or result in bad law on addressing generic burglary when under the existing law at the time, the burglary would qualify as under the residual clause. What Judge Baker did is he never ruled, as the court knows from reading this, on whether this is generic burglary or not. He simply found from reading the opinion that he didn't need to make that determination. I mean, implicitly, he decided that because he then just concluded, well, it also falls under the residual clause. He never even used those words, but his opinion basically said, you still qualify as an ACC. I think you could read it as him even finding that it qualified as generic burglary because he distinguishes the camps, but it's very unclear on that issue. And then he does state at the very end, it does involve conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another person, which is the residual clause, and then says the three predicates were proper. So the ruling is less than clear on the subject, but the position of the United States would be that ruling in a 2255 years later cannot turn the original sentencing into a Johnson claim, which is important for a subsequent section 2255, which is the context we're in. A lot of the cases, defense talks about Pross. I think they've also cited some Stanley cases, but we're in the context of a successive 2255. So 2255 H2 applies, and they have to base it on a new rule of constitutional law that's been retroactive by the Supreme Court, not previously available, and that would not apply to Mathis type claims.
Is Baker's order best read as a harmless error determination? The judge took up the claim of DeCamp error and said any error is harmless because this can be counted under the residual clause.
I think that would be right. I don't think he ever found error, but he basically said whether there's error or not is how I would read the opinion. Whether there is error or not, it's harmless because the residual clause would apply in this case. Now, again, going to the reply brief of the defense, they say this case is not Holtz, which is our argument. If this court's decision in Holtz said that you have to address the 2255 H2 issue even on appeal, even if the authority's been granted to bring the motion in the first place, because the defendant has to satisfy those requirements. And in Holt, this court found that a almost identical case where the defendant was raising Mathis to contest burglaries did not qualify under section 2255 H2. The defense cites to Van Cannon, saying this case is like Van Cannon, but in Van Cannon, it was not a successive 2255 case. Moreover, that was a case where the government confessed Johnson error. Johnson error. Again, in this case, there's never been any confession of Johnson error. They confessed that the case was under Johnson, but then argued that was harmless. And then the Seventh Circuit said, well, the defendant needs to be able to respond to the government's harmless error analysis, and therefore they can raise Mathis. And that makes sense. But this is not that case, because this isn't a case where there's any Johnson error conceded by the government at any stage of these proceedings. And so, as we know from the arguments when we're discussing about the prior burglary convictions, this is a Mathis claim. That's what this is. And there is some, maybe honored in the breach these days, but there are some rules of finality. And there are some rules that when we're looking at a sentencing, because it is hard to go back to 2002 and determine what exactly happened at that sentencing. That's why we have rules for finality. That's why we have rules such as 2255H2 that say that it has to be based on a new rule of constitutional law made retroactive by the Supreme Court. And that's not what we have here. Mathis is a statutory rule, not a constitutional law. It has not been made retroactive by the Supreme Court itself. And as we've discussed in the 2241 context, it's different, but it's also not a new rule. And so we believe that the defendant's relief should be denied under 2255H2, and that for the same reasons, it also doesn't qualify Section F1's requirements regarding timeliness, and also because it's a non-constitutional claim he's raising, that it's procedurally defaulted, and non-constitutional claims are procedurally defaulted without taking cause and prejudice into account. Beyond that, to go to the merits of the defendant's claim, the defendant did not raise in this oral argument and not much in the reply brief the Ohio attempted robbery conviction. We believe that it's, and I think defendants acknowledge that argument is foreclosed by this court's ruling in Hill. So we'll move on to the burglary cases. And the defense argues that somehow the United States should be judicially stopped from even arguing regarding the Ohio conviction's generic burglary. But we've discussed the jurisprudence on judicial estoppel. This isn't a case like the New Hampshire versus Maine case, where a state was taking a factual position about the location of a state boundary to its benefit and then changed its decision when it was later to its benefit. This is a case where it was not to the United States' benefit to take the position, to not argue, I should say, I guess, in the prior proceeding, that the Georgia statute qualified as generic burglary. So in that sense, in looking at this court's jurisprudence in Trudeau as to when to apply judicial estoppel, it's not a case where the United States prevailed in the prior proceeding based on the position it took on generic burglary. It was a position that the defendant agreed with, and it conferred no detriment to the defendant in that proceeding. So we don't believe judicial estoppel is appropriate, especially in this context of the modified categorical approach and the recent jurisprudence from the court, which the court itself has said is dizzyingly complex, to try to understand Stitt, to understand Quarles, to understand Greer. We believe the jurisprudence now establishes that the Georgia statute is generic burglary, the Ohio statute qualifies as generic burglary, and to not allow the United States to present that jurisprudence to the court wouldn't advance the interest of justice in any way. Our position that this defendant, who committed what we believe actually at the time 6 qualifying ACC convictions, that in reality did involve dwellings and burglaries, did involve violence, we don't think that that somehow is a miscarriage of justice, and we've always asserted that this defendant is an armed career criminal. So to get into the Ohio aggravated burglary statute, it's under Section A3 that was analyzed by both the district court and by the Sixth Circuit in Greer. And we thought it was somewhat interesting, at least, that on the exact same day, without the benefit of either one's jurisprudence, both the district court in this case and the Sixth Circuit in Stitt came to the exact same conclusion, that the Georgia burglary statute is generic burglary applying Stitt. It requires an occupied structure that could include vehicles, but it's been defined under in the statute as a permanent or temporary habitation where a person is present or likely to be present. Further defined as either a dwelling, a permanent or temporary habitation, adapted for overday and accommodation, or a place a person is present or likely to be present. And this is similar to the statutes in Tennessee and Arkansas that the Supreme Court held were generic burglary instead. The Sixth Circuit did an exhaustive analysis to show that 31 state statutes were either as broad or broader than the Ohio statute at the time the Armed Career Criminal Act was passed. Ultimately, the Sixth Circuit concluded, and we would ask this court to follow that, the Georgia statute, by the requirement that a person be present or likely to be present in the statute, does satisfy a generic burglary, and that it presents the same risk of violence because a person is present at the time.
Why are we doing the risk analysis at all?
I'm sorry?
Why would we do any kind of risk analysis at all?
I would agree with the court on that. I think, though, that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in Stitt perhaps left open somewhat the possibility of courts also looking to the risk analysis, which is what the Sixth Circuit did. But frankly, I agree with the court. We look at the elements of this offense. The elements of this offense meet the generic definition of burglary. And based on that alone, we believe both of these convictions qualify. And I'll briefly just turn to the Georgia statute with the defendant's other burglary convictions. We believe that the district court here erred in finding those convictions not qualify, because the district court relied on the Fourth Circuit's decision in Corvette, which had found that an intermediary Georgia court had found that a person did not need to be present in a vehicle for it to qualify as burglary under the Georgia statute. In 1977, the Supreme Court disagreed and said a person does have to be present. This defendant was convicted in 1978, after the Supreme Court of Georgia, the highest court in Georgia, had held that a person needs to be present, and that appears to still be good law in Georgia. With that ruling, the Georgia statute would satisfy the requirement under Stitt of it being generic burglary. But the alternative argument we would simply note is 5th, 6th, and 11th circuits, all before Stitt, held that the Georgia statute was divisible. And if the statute's divisible, because the Georgia lower courts had held that you must allege the location of the burglary in both the indictment and with the verdict. And in this case, there's no question that it was alleged in this case that the defendant actually entered the dwelling of two different individuals. And so as a divisible statute, the Georgia statute would also qualify as generic burglary. So we believe the defendant does still have 5 qualifying convictions, although we ultimately don't believe the court needs to reach those conclusions because he has not satisfied 2255H2.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Patton?
Yes, Your Honors, to be absolutely clear, this is on page 4 of our brief. This is what the government said, filed with Judge Baker in the first 2255. It's a direct quote. Wagner correctly observes that neither Ohio burglary statute meets the definition of generic burglary, i.e. unlawful or unprivileged entry into or remaining in a building or structure with intent to commit a crime, DeCamp 133 Supreme Court at 2283, quoting Taylor, because it includes the burglary of habitations like tents that are not buildings or structures, close quote. The government specifically said it was not generic burglary, but then went on and asked Judge Baker to find that it was still a violent felony only under the residual clause. And the point of the case is trying to decide whether the sentence is based on the residual clause. The timing isn't the issue. The issue is if you are trying to show that you have a Johnson claim, you have to show that you're found to be ACCA based on the residual clause. There is absolutely no doubt that Judge Baker found Mr. Wagner ACCA under the residual clause. He didn't make a harmless error finding Judge Sykes, because nobody asked him to find harmless error. The government said there is no error. They didn't say, hey, the statute's divisible, so you can do a modified categorical approach, so it counts both under generic burglary and residual burglary. They specifically said it does not count as generic burglary. If a defendant made that kind of concession to a court and came back and tried to change it, we'd get cut off at the knees. And the same should apply to the government. With the Georgia statute, the version of the statute that Mr. Wagner was convicted of didn't require, it was a different version of the statute than was at issue in Cornett from the Fourth Circuit. It does cover just entry into vehicles, and it is our position it's not divisible. The Fourth Circuit found that, but the 11th Circuit has found otherwise. The 10th Circuit has disagreed with that. There is a circuit split. Judge Myerscough identified that in her opinion, and we think she got it right on the Georgia burglaries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.